Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined by Peter Flaherty. After a bit of a week off, I'll take the L on that one. I was dealing with some sickness that I couldn't push through, but we're back here now. I guess it is about to be August, Peter. We're about to really dive into the 2026 draft cycle, but me and you have not had our post-mortem on the 2025 draft because I missed last week, so wanted to just kind of tie a bow on the 25 class, talk about the signing deadline, kind of break things down, get your thoughts on everything, and then maybe do a little preview of what we're expecting or what we're excited about for 26. So first of all, how are you? And also happy birthday as we record this.
Thank you. It's funny I get the birthday shout out because I'm like you. I'm not a huge birthday guy, so I like to keep it on the DL. But no, I appreciate it. It's been a great day. I'm very
now everyone knows.
I know. I was going to say, but no, I'm lucky to be surrounded by family and everyone that I love. So that's all I can really ask for. But I'm excited to do our final, I guess, wrap up and put a bow on the 25 class for good. I think now that the signing deadline's passed, we can officially turn the page to 26. So it's another nice landmark to hit.
Yeah, it does feel like we've spent, and I think part of this is because this cycle feels like our most consistent in terms of the amount of podcasts we've done covering a draft, but it does feel like we've spent years talking about this 25 class. So I am pretty excited to move on to 26. I think this is the case for every draft class. You just spent so much time talking about the players. You're excited about like the fresh new looks at new classes and just the excitement about discovering a draft class and seeing the players who really stand out to you and trying to line them up is always a fun new challenge. But you are right. Like so much of how we contextualize the draft has to do with the actual signing day, how much players signed for, seeing who would actually sign. This year, we had just two players in the first 10 rounds not sign contracts with their team. Angel Cervantes, the second rounder by the Pittsburgh Pirates, and then the Dodgers' sixth rounder, Mason Legenza, two high school players who didn't sign inside the top 10 rounds. Kind of a bit surprising for me. I was asked about this even earlier in the process where there's kind of some uncertainty about whether or not Cervantes would sign. I still expected him to because in recent years, teams have done a nice job identifying signability with high school players in particular, and it does feel like the college guys who have not signed have kind of been a little bit random. But yeah, what are your thoughts on those two not signing? I mean, the hit rate of top 10 round guys is still pretty high. And JJ Cooper wrote a piece, I think, just breaking down that this class was the highest percentage of signed players we've ever seen outside of COVID, which was a 5-year draft. So maybe the new norm in the 20 round draft to see basically 90% or more of players who are drafted actually getting signed.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty surprising because I don't have the exact number in front of me, but I remember you tipped everyone off leading up to the draft and in the wake of the draft, if guys weren't signing immediately that, you know, hey, I think 97 or 98% of all top 10 rounders do end up signing. So obviously, and I think just naturally, I'm more surprised about Cervantes not signing with Pittsburgh than I am Legenza with the Dodgers, just given where he's picked. He's a top 50 overall guy. But it sounds like that behind the scenes, there was, you know, it was an interesting one, just given the, you know, there may have been some more wrinkles to that one than initially realized, but it'll be a really fun piece for UCLA. So I think just naturally, I'm surprised that those two guys didn't sign, but outside of that, there weren't really any like huge, groundbreaking pieces of news. I think Cervantes was just because he went on Twitter at like 9:30 Eastern, like a week and a half ago, I think now, and broke it himself. And then Legenza, the deadline passed. And it seemed like as we got closer and closer to the deadline, that there was a little more buzz and traction with him eventually making it to campus and getting to Pitt, which is a huge get for Coach Bell and company and in a program that's always kind of been scrappy in the ACC. So that's immediately a really, really fun piece for him. And I'm excited to watch him for a couple of years.
Those two specific players not signing was really a bummer for me because Cervantes being the second round pick tied to Seth Hernandez is one of the reasons why I was so excited about Pittsburgh's class on night one. And so not having him really cuts into the excitement for that quite a bit. Although, as anyone who's listened to this podcast knows, any class that includes Seth Hernandez, I'm going to like to a strong degree, regardless of who's drafted after him. And then Legenza as well. He was, or Legenza, I might be butchering his name. You seem to be on top of it more than me. But
I was going
to
say, I think I'm butchering it. You went Legenza, but I think one of us got it right.
Mason was one of the players that me and you drafted our favorite picks on day two. And I really like the pick of Mason by the Dodgers because I feel like they are a team that is really well suited to help him actualize the tools and the upside that he has. Like, I think with some other teams, I maybe would have been a little bit more reserved about whether or not I'd be excited about his hitting upside. But in particular, the fit with the Dodgers was the reason that I drafted that pick as one of my favorites. So a little bit personally upsetting, I guess, to see two players and two player organization fits not come to pass. Outside of those two players not signing, was there anything that stood out to you about the bonuses, the best values in the class? Like, now that we can kind of see the money and see, like, with clarity, which players in the 11 to 20 round range are actually signing, what stands out to you? I'd say, as I'm throwing this at you and letting you collect your thoughts on it, I expected to see someone sign for a bit more than the $9 million that we saw Ethan Holliday sign for, and maybe I should have tempered my expectations for the biggest bonus in this class, but I mean, I don't think Holliday surprised anyone by being the biggest bonus. That was kind of where we were assuming it was going to go in the weeks and months leading up to this. Maybe worth noting that both Eli Willis and Ethan Holliday broke the record for biggest bonus for a high school player in the draft. Eli Willits topped Ethan's older brother Jackson with $8.2 million, and then Ethan Holliday signed a few days later and set the bonus once again at $9 million. Holliday now has a top five overall bonus, joining, I believe it's Paul Skeens, Chase Burns, Charlie Condon, Dylan Cruz. So they did well for just like historic high school players in the bonus pool era. But I kind of expected or assumed Holliday would either match or surpass Burns and Connor from a year ago. Maybe that was too bullish from me. But yeah, what are your thoughts on any actual bonuses or maybe classes?
I was expecting it like you with Holliday, just again, given the buzz leading into the draft and potential landing spots with him and maneuvering that, and also that he's a Boris guy. So I'm with you that I was expecting perhaps a little bit more of a juicy bonus there, but mm-hmm. I think with the Nationals and Willits going one, and I think you and I could go on a tangent on this one for an entire podcast episode. One, it was not all that surprising at all, first right. off, but second, I think they did a really nice job maneuvering the rest of the draft, especially in rounds 3, 4, and 5, signing yep. Landon Harmon, Miguel Cime, and Coy James, going 3 for 3 on those guys, all on pretty hefty overslot deals, especially Cime and Coy James. So I actually think they ended up with a really good class. Certainly when I'm a fan of the Tigers, you could kind of see a little bit similarly what they ended up doing, kind of making flashier and splash worthy picks with Jordan Yost and Michael Oliveto with their first and second overall picks. And they
give me your take on Detroit, because I am maybe more skeptical of Detroit's draft than any team's draft. And I know, I think Ben kind of shared some similar thoughts here. A lot of it just comes down to viewing their class while lining up the BA board beside it. We did a piece on the best and worst values of the class, just using slot values tied to BA 500 player rankings, and then comparing those rankings and BA values, quote unquote, with the actual signing bonuses. And based on that, which again, I don't think is an exact science. I think there's a lot of room to maybe adjust the values you might personally have on players here. So I'm not saying like that this Tigers class is horrible by any means. It could very well turn out to be good and much better than I'm expecting. But I would say, like, based on the capital Detroit had and then just some of the players available, it had me kind of scratching my head. I like Jordan Yost and Michael Oliveto to varying degrees. It's just like where they had to sign them and pay them. I would have just rather had some other players. But then you also look further down their board and I don't quite understand what happened with Nick Dumanel being available, first of all, in the eighth round and also signing for $216,000. $214,000, you're right. I guess underslot with the signing bonus contingency. But like between those three players, we've got two of our worst values in the entire draft and then one of our best overall values. So it's just an odd draft class for me. And then I think you could also push back and say, hey, it's also very Detroit-esque because Oliveto and Yost are hitterish high school left-handed bats that they have seemed to like in recent years. So what are your thoughts on that one?
I like Jordan Yost and Michael Oliveto. Liked him going into the draft, and it seemed to be the general sentiment that Oliveto was going to go in a really good spot. Mm-hmm. On the first day, I was not expecting to hear his name called at 34 again. Mm-hmm. Two good players. Like, Yost is an up the middle profile. If he doesn't stick at shortstop, there's a chance he shifts and moves to the grass and plays center field. Plus runner, borderline plus hit. How much power and impact he grows into, I'm not as bullish on, but there are fun tools there. He's a really, really good athlete. The contact ability stands out. Oliveto, much like really any amateur catcher, whether it be collegiately or in high school, the defensive skill set does need work. But the offensive package is really appealing. Like, there's a chance he's an above average hit and above average power guy. I like those two players in a vacuum, but mm-hmm. where they got him was kind of two of the main surprises, I would say, on night one. And then to your point, with Dumanil being one available still in the eighth,
crazy,
you getting him on an underslot deal, like that one is so weird to me. And like,
yeah, I'm like,
am I missing something? Because
that's exactly what I've been thinking the whole time. I'm like, did we really just overstuff him in the rankings? Do we think he's way better than he actually, like, clearly we thought he's better than the industry paid him and selected him for. I don't entirely know what happened. I know on day two, we were talking about it. We were looking at our best available board. And typically, once you get into day two, that best available board quickly becomes a bunch of high school players. You're like, okay, these guys are just either unsignable now or they're going to go in a later round and they're going to get overpaid. Like, that's what happens. And then for the longest time, it was Henry Ford and Nick Dumanel sitting at the top. And with Ford, you can again kind of rationalize that one. He's a draft eligible sophomore. If he starts to slip a little bit and doesn't get the amount of money that maybe he was expecting to get or hoped to get, he can very easily make the case, hey, I've got more eligibility than a typical college player. Let's run it back, try again next year. That makes sense. We've seen that happen before. With Dumanel, it's just like, what is happening? Is there a medical situation that we don't know about? That might be the easiest answer. Like, sometimes when players slip and we don't really know why, it's just because teams have medical information. But man, that was a real puzzler for me. So I cannot wait to see, like, 5 years from now, what Dumanel's career looks like.
I'm with you, because like, coming out of the summer and like, I got a number of looks at him. Mm-hmm. I had him like mentally in the like second to fourth round range. Right. Like, and I mean, there were tools there. I remember in the All-Star game, and this is talking about the Cape League. He topspun a homer to the pull side at like 105, 106. And I was like, you know, he's a strong athletic kid, plus runner, really good athlete. Like, yeah, there's a chance he moves off of center field eventually, and the hit tool might be a little bit light with right on right spin, but the tools here are really, really exciting. But and for them to get him in the eighth was, you know, I think you cited it as one of your favorite picks on day two, and rightfully so. Yeah. So
it felt like a layup, because it's just such a highly ranked player in that range that you don't see too often. So it's almost like you don't have to think too hard about picking that as a pick to like, but man, it's just weird.
Yeah, and if all is good on the health side, I mean, I have no reason to believe otherwise. Like,
yeah,
I'm with you in this being an excellent pick and really good value, especially the fact that they really didn't have to pay a whole lot to get him there. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, similar to the Nationals and other clubs, you kind of saw what they're doing a little bit with buying River Hamilton down to the 11th. That's a fun arm with intriguing upside. So mm-hmm. That was one of the more interesting classes, I would say.
Yeah, I'm trying to. So we've got this piece, best and worst values of the draft. You can, if you want, like, some sort of like post-draft ranking of talent. We don't do that because it just feels like a dishonest way to go about evaluating a draft class. We need 5 years. We need 10 years to really see which class is actually panned out. Like, we just have to have a lot more humility and uncertainty and like acknowledging where these players are going to wind up. But like, you can look and see which classes the BA board likes best, based on this value exercise that we've done. So some of the top teams, just in terms of total BA value coming away from the draft this year, the Orioles, unsurprisingly, just given all the pick capital, bonus pool money they had to work with, the Rockies, number two, the Nationals, who you mentioned. I also really like how they attacked the board this year, getting a very solid 1-1 sort of player in Eli Willits, and then loading up on high school upside guys. I like the Marlins, the Mariners, the Red Sox, maybe as the most out of place team here, just in terms of them ranking this high with a more pedestrian bonus pool and pick capital. At the bottom end, we've got teams like the Mets, the Yankees, the Astros, who picked later, didn't have a lot of money to work with, the Tigers, who we talked about, the Giants and the Padres. Do you find yourself liking any particular team because they just happen to take a lot of players that you really found yourself liking? One of the teams for me that I really find myself just liking their class a lot is the Diamondbacks. We have them as like very middle of the pack in terms of total BA value. We've got them nearly neutral in terms of expected value based on the bonuses they handed out and in our assessment of like the BA draft value of these players. But they took Cason Cunningham in the first round, 18th overall. I was very happy to see Cunningham not slide into the 20s. I know we had talked about that potentially happening, just given some questions about size, but the D-backs, one of the more aggressive teams on shorter hitters. And then they took a bunch of live arms that I really like after that. Patrick Forbes, I do think, is a little bit risky at 29, just given his control issues. But the fact that they have that 29th pick as their second pick helps kind of stomach some of the risk a little bit for me. And I do think his arm talent is super exciting. Brian Curley, I think, was a player that we talked about a lot that we liked down the stretch, just like a flamethrower with a really hard slider. I'll be curious to see what sort of role he winds up pitching in. And then both Dean Livingston and Joe Arriola, really, fourth and seventh round picks, are pitchers that I don't know that I had super strong opinions on one way or another, but both of them were really impressive at the combine for me and their bullpens. And so then digging into them a little bit more, I found myself liking them a bit more often. I do wonder how many strikes Arriola is going to throw. That has been a real question, but maybe he can pull a sort of Brandon Clark transformation, going from this real erratic strike thrower and then parlaying a really solid bullpen at the combine into better strikes in pro ball. So I really find myself just liking a lot of the arms, getting excited about the upside, and then loving the fact that they took who I view as the best pure hitter in this class at 18. So that's one for me.
Yeah, they got off to a great start with Case, and I love the hitability with him, like you. And then with Arriola, if they can get him consistently in and around the strike zone and throwing quality strikes, it's a left-hander who's got a chance for 3+ pitches when all is said and done. Now, that's a big if with getting him around the zone, but if they're able to do it and accomplish that within their player and pitching development departments, that's a huge win and really good value getting him in the seventh. I like Baltimore's class a lot. I know you touched on it mainly for their first 5 picks with Ike Irish, then going back-to-back with Caden Bodine and Vahevo Aloy, Slater DeBrun and Joseph Jirwa, like those 5 guys. That's a really, really legit group. Irish, whether or not he sticks behind the dish is a little bit of a question mark, but you're buying the offensive profile with him with the 55 hit and 55 power. Bodine, for me, was the best catcher in this year's class, no doubt, plus defender. One of, I think, 2 or 3 guys that had a plus hit tool attached to them in the final BA 500, or at least within the first however many guys. But outstanding feel for the barrel, really advanced offensive profile. He's hit at every single stop. I have no reason to believe that he'll buck that trend as he gets into pro ball. Vahevo won the Golden Spikes Award. Hit tool took a step in the right direction this spring, though he still needs some you know, it still needs to take a step forward against right on right spin. But I think now, and I think a lot of people share this feeling, I'm more confident in his ability to stick at shortstop now than I was, you know, coming into this season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the internal clock got better. He's got arm strength through the position. Slater DeBrun was one of my favorite looks at World Woodbat. Down in Jupiter, prototypical bouncy leadoff guy with fun tools. Popular body comp and somewhat of a player comp with him is Slade Caldwell and then Joseph Jirwa. That's a really fun clay to mold, 6'8" lefty, interesting fastball, changeups above average and will flash plus. And even JT Quinn was excellent on the Cape pre-draft, huge boost to his stock. He made himself a ton of money out here. And then the Red Sox pitching in particular, I like Kyson Witherspoon, we're a huge fan of. Marcus Phillips at 33 was a little bit of an eyebrow.
The Red Sox have really just done a nice job of just letting someone out of the top tier fall to them in the middle of the first round and capitalizing. Brandon Montgomery a year ago, and then Kyson Witherspoon, the guy who, I mean, I guess we had him mocked a few times in this range, but I view him as a comparable talent to the Jamie Arnolds and Liam Doyles and Tyler Bremners of the world who went quite a bit in front of him. So I think that's a good one as well.
Yeah, I mean, Kyson could have very well gone inside the top 10 picks. And I don't think either of us would have blinked.
Yep.
And the value pick that I love, and we were doing our draft night stream when it happened, but Anthony Ianson at 87.
Yeah.
My favorite picks in the draft. Obviously, they got him for a little bit of an overslot deal at a shade under 2 mil at 175. But man, that at 87 is what a coup they pulled off. Because, I mean, he's a plus strike thrower, no doubt starter. The fastball quality is obviously a little light. But he's got two legit and distinct breaking balls that both draw empty swings. Real four-pitch mix that he rounds out with a changeup that's a fine fourth offering. I mean, I think he's going to pitch in the big leagues. I don't think he's going to be a number one or a number two starter, but I think he's a really, really good arm, and I'm excited to see them develop him because the Red Sox recently and perhaps underratedly have a really good pitching development department, and they do an excellent job. So these are three really fun arms at the top that they get to work with and kind of mold.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Ianson. There are a couple other players that fit into a similar sort of bucket for me that are similar to him and just like great values on the college side that I was really surprised to see them last as long as they did. The other one was Max Belou, who went in the supplemental second round to the Rockies, 74th overall pick. I mean, he's a player who we had ranked in a very similar spot to Ianson. I think if he's fully healthy, there's a chance we're talking about like an actual first round pick here. I don't know how much like the injury with him was more of a question or just the profile, like some thoughts about whether or not he is going to be a corner player at the next level, but they didn't even have to pay him a huge bonus. It was exactly slot value, $1.1 million at 74th overall. So it's not even the case where like Ianson, where you're paying a little bit to get him down to you, which again is generally just hard to do for a college player. The other one, I feel like I've found myself becoming more and more of a fan of this player, and I like him even more now, just given the bonus and the pick he was selected at. But Alex Lodice at 60th overall, like I can understand not wanting to pull the trigger on him in the first round because there are some just aggressive tendencies to his approach. But I think just tool set, performance this spring, I really think he's a good defender at shortstop. I look at the Braves getting him in the second round, signing him for an underslot deal at 60th overall. I think that's a tremendous value. Lodice actually checks in as the second best overall value in our class behind Seth Hernandez. Belou is on that list, I believe. Anthony Ianson is also on that list. So those are kind of just three of the college guys that I think are excellent values in the top three rounds, and kind of surprised they were able to get as far down the board as they did.
I'm with you. If this is a full video podcast, you'll see one of my cats interrupting briefly.
We love that.
I'm with you. Belou, I think a lot of it has to do with the injury, and it wasn't just for him, at least. what he dealt with during the season. I think during the fall he got banged up. There was maybe a hammy issue in there. So I think there's a little bit of an iffy track record of staying on the field and staying healthy. And Lodice as well, I think value-wise, that's outstanding value. The Braves got at pick 60. Now, we were in the same camp of, yeah, first round is a little bit rich for Lodice, lacks hitability, but snagging him at 60, I'm a huge fan of it because, I mean, he's an above-average defender at short. You can feel pretty confident with him sticking at the position. I think the impact and the ability that he has to drive the baseball, and we saw it this year more than any other year of him at the amateur level, was really, really impressive. So if he can shore up the hit tool even a little bit and make contact on a consistent basis against pro arms, and like a lot of these guys, particularly against right-on-right spin, and you know, if he can see shapes better, there's a chance for a really enticing profile. So those two stood out to me. And then outside of that, there weren't any like crazy spots or egregious spots. I think the Phillies getting Gage Wood at 26 was also an A-plus pick inside that first to second round range. I was honestly surprised he lasted that long. I know he was on a rocket ship and had all the momentum in the world. And, you know, he started out ranked well outside the first round, but I wouldn't have been surprised. And we were talking about it on one of our podcasts leading up to the draft. And if he had gone in the mid-teens, I mean, I think the profile with him is really, really exciting. One of the best fastballs in the draft, above average curveball to boot, consistently around the strike zone. He has the enough pitchability where he can command and locate his arsenal enough to where he maximizes it. So I really like that pick as well.
Yeah, and just looking at like how every team spent this year, once again, I mean, every team is using their full bonus pool. I know there's a lot of fans who think that when you see underslot deals, teams are being cheap. But if you just look at the total pool spend for every team this year, only three teams didn't spend a full 100% of their pool. And if you look at those three teams, it's basically rounding errors for those. The Brewers spent 99.9%. The Cardinals spent 99.7%. The D-backs spent 99.2%. We had nine teams that went to the full 5% overage. That's the Guardians, the Mets, the Tigers, the Phillies, the Blue Jays, the Dodgers, the Orioles, the Nationals, and the Angels. There were four teams that were just barely outside of that range at 4.9% overage: the Astros, Padres, White Sox, and Giants. So nothing too surprising there. Just over $400 million in total signing bonus spend for the draft this year. We also saw one of the biggest undrafted free agent deals with Trace Phillips with the Blue Jays, or the Rays, with the Rays, So second largest undrafted free agent bonus behind just TJ Friedl, who was 2016, to the Reds. So that was kind of fun to see after the fact as a guy we had ranked inside the top 200. Those are kind of my final thoughts on the draft. I'll let you have the final word, Peter, on if there's anything you want to mention before we turn the page to 26.
Yeah, I mean, not to beat a dead horse here because it's already, you know, it's come and gone, but like the narrative of the Nationals being cheap and like the whole, I guess, discussion around the Eli Willits pick is, it drove me nuts for probably longer than I'd like to admit, but they took the player that was first on their board, like undoubtedly. Like if Ethan Holliday was the first player on the board, they were going to take him and sign him. If Cade Anderson was the number one player on the board, they would have taken him and signed him too. Like, it just happens to be that Eli Willits, it works out well because, and rightfully so, Eli Willits is a really, really good player. He was their guy. They got their guy. It works out well where they can sign him for an underslot deal. And you saw exactly how they were able to maneuver that and maximize it in rounds 3 through 5 and get really a trio of high quality prep guys who had buzz significantly higher than where they were drafted. So I like the Nationals class in general, obviously fronted by and led by their early round picks. But I really like the Eli Willits pick at one. Offensive profile, super enticing. The defensive skill set and athleticism at shortstop is also really appealing. I think he's going to stick there. So just kind of wanted to give them their flowers a little bit.
Yeah. And it does seem like the Nationals have clearly, the last two drafts, like just targeting players with contact skills has been something of an emphasis, or seemingly an emphasis for them. And we talked about it all spring, like there's not a lot separating these top hitters in the class. If you wanted more of a power oriented bat, Ethan Holliday could be your guy. And if you wanted Willits, who's just an exceptionally well-rounded player who does a lot of things well and is now the youngest ever 1-1 pick. And that group of players, the youngest ever to go 1-1, is a pretty successful group of names. So I also generally like their class. Think Eli Willits was more than deserving to be the 1-1, and not disparaged as some sort of like cheap cop-out pick. He was ranked number 3 on our board. Peter, I think you had said multiple times that he was in consideration for the first pick for you. If you were picking there, I'd said throughout the process that if I was taking a hitter, I would take Eli Willits. So, yeah, excited to see what he's going to do, what this class is going to pan out for Washington, because we like the pick individually. The BA board likes the pick, and their class as a whole, we had them as the third best in terms of total BA value and nearly $2 million more in value than expected given their bonus pool. So kudos to the Nationals for that. And with that, Peter, let us kick this 2025 draft out of the room. Let's move into 2026. I'm flying out tomorrow as we're recording this to East Coast Pro. Can't wait for that event. I'll do East Coast Pro then Area Codes. I know you've already been active on the Cape. You've been better than me in terms of seeing these 2026 guys. So I guess briefly now, we don't need to spend too much time because it has been already 30 minutes on this pod, but how excited for 2026 are you? Because I don't know that I've mentioned it on this podcast specifically, but I think this is the most anticipated draft class I've ever had. And that's like dating back to the 2018, which was my first like full cycle with BA. I think this is the, like, whether it's just from like hearing you and Ben talk about the players or hearing scouts, like really get amped about the high school talent, like the high school side in particular is what I'm excited about. So these next 2 weeks is going to be a blast for me, but where's your head at in terms of anticipation for 26?
Well, one, I'm jealous that you're going down to ECP because it's a loaded field, chock full of all these, you know, really talented underclassmen. But one, I'm just excited to turn the page and talk about a new group of players. And I think what adds to that is the quality of the class. I mean, they've got a ton of juice, both on the college side and also the prep side. And the prep side, I mean, there's a ton of talent. I like a ton of the college guys as well. I think the top of the class is, you know, it's led by Rock Chalowski, and there are a number of guys who could play their way higher and into that range. AJ Gracia is one of them. Justin LeBron's another. Derek Curiel at LSU. I'm curious to see how much impact he grows into. But on record right now, my sleeper 1-1 guy, and I don't know how much of a sleeper you can even call it, because right now he's 14th on our 2026 combined rankings as of like 2 weeks ago when it was released. But Sawyer Strassnider from TCU.
Calling your shot now is Strassnider. Okay, I like
it. Yeah, just a tool shed to the nth degree. It's a ton of fun now, skills and tools and upside. And I think I was most encouraged by what the hit tool looked like this spring at TCU. That was kind of one of the main question marks. The swing could get a little long and there was some whiff coming out of high school, but he fared really well this spring. Tons of bat speed, plus power to the pull side, plus arm, plus runner. Probably profiles best in a corner spot long term. So I guess to take out one of my favorite phrases, like if the hit tool adds like a coat of polish, that only serves him well. But he got off to a really slow start too, like classic freshman growing pains. I think he was hitting a shade under 170 in the middle of March, and then he just flipped a switch and went gangbusters, led the country with 10 triples. Like there are just a ton of fun tools here with Strassnider. Now that I'm talking through him, we might even have him a little underranked at 14, which is kind of crazy to say, but he very well could play his way into the 1-1 convo.
Yeah, I mean, right now the 1-1 convo. Jeez, I can get through this. I remember how to podcast and say words.
The yips.
Rochelowski at UCLA, he's dominating the 1-1 conversation right now. It was a fairly no-brainer decision for us, for you, Ben, and Jacob to kind of put him into that spot. I don't know that we've had a college shortstop that is as dynamic a prospect, as well-rounded a prospect at the shortstop position in the college ranks since I've been doing this at Baseball America. I do think, looking at some of the top college shortstop profiles to go, we've had a lot of really good ones. Jacob Wilson was a very unique prospect that certainly didn't have the kind of well-rounded game that Rock brings to the table, but had this sort of uncanny contact ability that is clearly allowing him to make his mark at the big league level right now. I'm trying to even think through some of the other shortstops that have gone like top 10, top 5 off the top of my head in the college ranks recently. Like Nick Madrigal played the position, but like second base seemed more likely for him. So there really have not been a lot of super elite high-end guys that go in this range from the college shortstop position. I do wonder like how we're going to compare Chalowski to guys like Dansby Swanson, to guys like Alex Bregman. He's already like added himself to a really elite group of players by winning the BA Player of the Year award as an underclassman. We've rarely had players do that. And that group of players is pretty successful in terms of just like what they went on to do in their big league careers. It really does feel like Rock has gone from top 50 prospect coming out of high school, who is really well regarded for defensive ability, athleticism, just buttery smooth around the bag, super instinctual player with some offensive tools, and now has layered on a lot of conviction and just his overall offensive game with 2 years of really strong performance, obviously coming off an exceptional year in 2025. It feels like I remember talking about this class at this stage last year, and we were talking about how there were a lot of players with question marks in their profiles. To me, Rock is a pretty bulletproof prospect right now, and I wonder if that will just remain to be the case, and if he'll have like a sort of wire-to-wire Dylan Cruz, Adley Rutschman sort of track for this year's class.
I think he kind of fits into that bucket right now, and it's hard to argue against it just given what he did. I mean, he could defend in the big leagues right now. I have no doubt about it. It's a plus defender at shortstop, and it's a whole lot of this is what it looks like: arm strength, buttery smooth action, super soft hands, advanced internal clock. Like, the baseball sense with him is off the charts, both offensively and defensively. Like, that's a quality that shines across all facets of his game, and he grew into a lot more impact this year. He was consistently on the barrel. I think his 90th percentile exit velocity was 106.5, posted multiple batted balls over 110. And what's really impressive to me, he's got plus bat to ball skills on top of his knack for being on the barrel and consistently generating quality contact. He has no issue pulling the ball in the air and lifting the ball to the pull side, which is a contributing factor in his massive uptick in power. That was huge for him, just getting the ball up in the air to the pull side. He handles velo really well. I think against all pitches, 92 plus, he hit 340. He does have the qualities in the making of a someone, at least in terms of where they're selected, of like a Dylan Cruz or an Adley Rutschman, even though Dylan didn't go 1-1. A guy who just stays here.
These are the college shortstops. So these are all college players who have at least been selected at shortstop, who've gone inside the top 10 picks, going back to that Dansby Swanson, Alex Bregman draft. So in 2025, we just had Iva Arquette, 7th overall. In 2024, we had JJ Weatherholt, 7th overall. In 2023, we had Jacob Wilson, 6th overall. In 2022, we had Brooks Lee, 8th overall. In 2020, we had Austin Martin and Nick Gonzalez, 5th and 7th overall. So Austin Martin is the first like top 5 player. You have to go back to 2020 to get a top 5 college shortstop. Going further, we've got 2018, Nick Madrigal, 4th overall. And I think with both Madrigal and Nick Gonzalez, most people probably thought they were moving to second base at the next level, or at least there was some question about that. And then 2015, you get Dansby Swanson, Alex Bregman, first and second overall. I would expect that we're going to get our second, I guess, third draft since 2015 with a top five college shortstop. And unless Rock Chulowski completely falls apart, which I don't anticipate, seems like just a pretty classic 1-1 sort of candidate that's
yeah.
A really deep, really exciting group of players. So
it's a pretty ironclad profile. And I mean, just on the college side at the top of the class, like it's a really, really fun group, and there's depth to it as well. Just taking a quick scan through our 100, like, you know, even guys who are the first handful of players off of it, and a clearer picture will be painted of that when an updated college 100 comes out in a couple of weeks. But you know, Hunter Karn sitting there at 78, Jack Natilli at 77, Dalton Wentz and Cam Kojal also in the 70s. Cole Carlone is going to be Arizona State's Friday guy, plus fastball slider combo. Like it's a very exciting group, and it doesn't stop on the college side. Like, you know, even me, who's pretty college oriented and college centric, I'm super juiced up about the prep class.
There's just so many up the middle, toolsy, athletic high school profiles, like the Grady Emerson and Jacob Lombard duo at the very top, Tyler Spangler, shortstop out of California. You've got tool sheds like Kevin Roberts out of Mississippi, Brady Harris out of Florida. It really does seem like a bit of a resurgence for Florida in particular. There's just a ton of talent in Florida. Gio Rojas, left-handed pitcher, out of the absolute powerhouse that is Stoneman Douglas High in Parkland, Florida. I'll see basically all those guys over the next few weeks. So I'm absolutely stoked, and I'm sure I'll have much more to say about them when I get back. So can't wait.
I'm jealous, but I got a really good look at, you know, Jacob Lombard, who you'll see in Jupiter in October, and like the tools with him are real. I know it was kind of a slow circuit for him at times this summer, but it seems like he kind of got going recently. But just elite athlete. I'm just kind of curious to see how much he hits, but man, he's a really, really fun player. Grady Emerson also fits in that bucket. Like those are two, I'd say the two main prepsters along with Spangler that fit in the 1-1 convo and in that top tier right now.
Yeah. If you guys want more of a taste of what's coming for 2026, definitely would encourage you guys to check out the list that the Peter and Ben were kind of the backbone in putting together for us on the site. There are reports and rankings for all the top 100 players in the class already, which is a godsend for me. So you guys have basically handed this class to me on a silver platter and make my life a lot easier. So I appreciate that, Peter.
Hey, it's the least we could do. The least we could do.
Cool. Well, that's all I got for today. Anything else you want to mention before we get out of here?
No, nothing on mine. I'd say the biggest thing is the trade deadline tracker, which is up on baseballamerica.com right now. I know I've been using it even the last couple of days to keep up with everything and reading reports on guys. So every trade will be in there and broken down, at least the bigger ones. And then yesterday completed the top 100 transfer portal rankings, fully updated with everyone after the signing deadline. So guys that were previously on there, like Ryan Weidman, AJ Soldra, etc., are no longer on there, and they've been replaced. Last year it was up at the end of August. We pushed that up by almost a month. So you have full 100 on those guys with reports, and then coming down the pike, as we both alluded to, a college top 100 in a couple weeks for 2026, a college top 50 by the end of August. So even though the page has kind of turned a little bit and the 2026 cycle is in its infancy stages, there will be no shortage of coverage going on around it. And we'll get back into a groove here with the draft pod and keep it rolling on a weekly basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. That's all I have. Well said, Peter. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for supporting BA and hanging out. We really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed the draft, the signing deadline. Hope you guys are excited for 2026. Hope the trade deadline goes good for all of your teams out there. If you're looking to get an upgrade or you want some exciting prospects coming back, if you're rebuilding, best of luck to you guys on that front. So for Peter, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody.